2022, Wikimedia became suspicious of efforts to exert control over content and launched an investigation. Last month, it announced global bans for 16 users who were engaging in conflict of interest editing on Wikipedia projects in the MENA, that is the Middle East and North Africa region. In a statement at the time, Wikimedia said they were able to confirm that a number of users with close connections with external parties were editing the platform in a coordinated fashion to advance the aim of those parties, but didn't disclose the exact location or identity of the banned users.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers, dear sisters, salamun alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have an interesting story, and I invite you to listen to it. Story of the Sparrow and the Elephant is the title of today's story. Be with us. A long time ago, Mr. and Mrs. Sparrow lived in the forest. They made their nest on a branch of a blackberry tree. Soon, Mrs. Sparrow laid eggs in the nest. Mr. and Mrs. Sparrow became very happy. Mr. Sparrow took care of her and their eggs. But one day, a big, giant, and cheeky elephant came near their tree. He started pulling the branches. The sparrow couple got scared after watching this. They pleaded, "Oh, dear elephant, please show mercy. This is our beautiful nest. We laid eggs in the nest. We are waiting for our children to come out eagerly. Please don't break the branches or else our beautiful dreams will also be broken." But that selfish elephant did not listen to anything. He continued destroying that place. At last, he broke that branch. This made the eggs fall and break in a blink of an eye. Mr. and Mrs. Sparrow started crying. Seeing this horrible incident, the sparrow couple's friends came to console them. Some friends were so deeply affected by this incident that they decided to punish the elephant. The mastermind frog made a plan to punish the elephant. He included gnat and woodpecker into his plan. On the next day, all started to search for the arrogant elephant. Later, they found him near the mango tree. "Let us excuse the plan," said the genius frog. Following the order of the mastermind frog, gnat went near the elephant and started buzzing into his ear. This made the elephant angry, and soon he lost control over his body. As he lost control and started to panic, the woodpecker flew towards him and took his eyes off. Moaning in severe pain, the elephant started crying. Due to intemperate pain and excessive crying, his throat started drying up. He went here and there in search of water, but he could not see anything, listening to tar, 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 the sound of the frog. The elephant thought that he found the lake. He went near the ditch, following the frog's croak. The frog jumped into the lake. Thus the blind elephant assured himself that he had reached the correct place. As he went down to drink some water, he fell into the ditch and died soon after. As all friends took revenge using their intelligence, all animals and birds cheered their win and started dancing and singing. A friend in need is a friend indeed.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, today we are going to talk about this famous proverb that says, a friend in need is a friend indeed. From the viewpoint of Islam, friendship and what becomes the basics of relationships must be based on divine motivations. For us, in order to know what the general rule of maintaining a friendship, a friend's relationship or friendship is from the perspective of the Holy Quran, let's just pay attention to the translation of verse 24 of Surah As-Sad, chapter As-Sad. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in this surah, وَإِنَّ كَثِيرًا مِنَ الْخُلَطَاءِ لَيَبْغِي بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ وَقَلِيلٌ مَا هُمْ وَظَنَّ دَاوُودُ أَنَّمَا فَتَنَّاهُ فَاسْتَغْفِرْ لَهُ فَاسْتَغْفَرَ رَبَّهُ وَخَرَّ رَاكِعًا وَأَنَابَ. And indeed, many partners bully one another and accept such as have faith and do righteous deeds, and few are they. Then David knew that we had tested him, whereat he pleaded with his Lord for forgiveness and fell down in prostration and repented. You see, dear brothers and sisters, or what we understand here, that whatever we want to do and whatever the reason can be the reason for our friendship, we have to consider the divine bonds for this sort of relations. If we consider them as the key bonds in our relation, that friendship will stay and will be durable. And in case we are far from each other and we move to another region or another city or another country, this friendship is not going to fade. And if again this friendship is again has been based on the divine motivations, then the temptations of Satan and devil will not affect that. The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So, how can we make this a sort of friendship for ourselves? So let's test ourselves for these sort of friendships. Let's start this friendship with the person or the entity or the existence who has created us. Let's just start with him first. Then we can actually apply it to others. I think the one who created us is closer to us in our morale, in our, let's say, sensations and feelings and sympathy. So let's start this friendship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then apply it to others. The same way that we start this friendship with Him, which would be, at the end of the day, an enriched sort of friendship, we shall see that no other friendship can be like that. So, all in all, I wanted to tell our dear brothers and sisters that in case we want to make any relation with anyone, we have to actually give a sort of, let's say, a flavor of divinity, a flavor of spirituality to it. Then this friendship we shall find would be more durable and it will stay longer. And in case we want to test ourselves, we can start it and we can test ourselves with a friendship that we create and we make with our Lord, that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'd like to invite all of the brothers and sisters to start this friendship and practice it and apply it to those friends that we have in this world. We shall see and we shall taste the beauty and the sweetness of this friendship. Till our next show, I leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted.
So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar. Words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department, and so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there, and so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. Glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so...
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together in the code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
State of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support. But I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So, of course, they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a policeman or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson in Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
For now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a 6-year-old student has been taken into custody after allegedly shooting his female teacher at Richneck Elementary School in Virginia. The student's identity has not been publicly released and the teacher is said to be in a critical condition. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered the story and tells us more. A 6-year-old boy has been taken into police custody after he allegedly deliberately shot his first grade teacher at his Virginia elementary school, leaving her critically ill. Newport News police have taken a student who has not been publicly identified into custody. The unidentified female teacher, who is said to be in her 30s, was reportedly shot in the stomach and has been taken to Riverside Regional Medical Center in Virginia. The individual is a 6-year-old student and is right now in police custody, Newport News Chief Scott Drew said at a press conference on Friday, 6th of January. "This was not an accidental shooting," Scott Drew said. "It was in a classroom. An altercation took place there," he said. "We did not have a situation where someone was going around the school shooting. We had a situation in one particular location where a gunshot was fired." The incident unfolded at Richneck Elementary School, a school for kids aged 5 to 9, just before 2 p.m. on Friday, 6th of January. No children were harmed and police are working to figure out how the child had access to the gun. A grandmother of one of the students told the Daily Mail that a student brought shiny gold bullets to school last week, but it is unclear if it's the same child who was taken into police custody today. The grandmother, who asked not to be named, said the child had allegedly brought bullets to school last week and said he would bring his gun. A parent told the school they did nothing. "Now look," she wrote on Facebook. Speaking to the Daily Mail, she said, "The parents outside stated that their child told them a kid brought golden shiny bullets to school and was thinking about bringing his gun. The student told the parent, who informed the school. And the school just yesterday got back to the parent saying the parent of the kid said it was a Nerf bullet and the parents said Nerf bullets aren't shiny and they aren't gold. She was not positive if the child who brought the bullets is the same child allegedly involved in the shooting incident on Friday. The school, however, does have the capability of metal detecting students, Superintendent George Parker said at a press conference. They do not perform the test on every student every day, but said every school in the district has the capability to do so. When we have a perceived threat or issue, we do random metal detection on those days, Superintendent George Parker said on Friday, 6th of January. It is unclear if the school had enhanced testing after the bullet claim the week prior. Today, our students got a lesson in gun violence, Superintendent George Parker said. We need to keep the guns out of the hands of our young people. A British parent of one of the students who is currently based in the United States, as her husband is in the military, is now demanding the town do something about the gun problem. Guns, that's the biggest problem in this country, she told WTKR. Why is there a 7-year-old boy with a gun? How does a 7-year-old have a gun? I'm only here because my husband is in the military, otherwise I would not have chosen to come to this country. Superintendent George Parker said the school would be closed on Monday, 9th of January, to work on the mental health of our staff and students. The Australian Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. A 6-year-old boy allegedly shot and wounded a teacher at Richneck Elementary School in Newport News, Virginia, United States, prompting consternation from local officials who vowed to find answers and prevent such an event from happening again. The injury to a teacher, a woman in her 30s, was considered life-threatening, although she had shown some improvement in her health in hospital, Police Chief Steve Drew told reporters. There was no further explanation of how the 6-year-old boy had acquired the handgun. Police described it as an altercation in the first grade classroom that resulted in one shot being fired. This was not an accidental shooting, Police Chief Steve Drew said. I want to know where that firearm came from. Police Chief Steve Drew said the boy was in police custody. No student was injured in the incident, but they had been moved to a gymnasium for their safety and counsellors have been made available, he said. They are safe, they are interacting with officers and having some fun, snapping some high fives and teasing each other, Drew said. Students were reunited with their parents under a school escort. Right now, it's still raw, but what I will tell you is there's going to be a full after-action report, not only internally from the City Council with the school board and others, but we're going to ensure that we have the right steps and policies so that this doesn't happen again, Newport News Mayor Philip Jones told reporters. In the same news conference, School Superintendent George Parker lamented educators' inability to keep guns out of schools, saying he was shocked and disheartened by the incident. We need to keep guns out of the hands of our young people, Superintendent George Parker said. I cannot control access to weapons. My teachers cannot control access to weapons. Superintendent George Parker said all school campuses are equipped for random metal detector searches, but they were not deployed at Richneck Elementary School on Friday, 6th of January, 2023.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
The fifth point is that no part of the powers or legal duties of the judiciary, as defined in the Constitution or related laws, should be suspended. No part of them should be suspended. For instance, the Attorney General has certain duties in the field of public law. He should have full knowledge of public law so that he can be sure that public rights are not violated. This should be taken very seriously, and the law must be resorted to wherever it felt that public rights are being violated. But I do not agree with the use of emotions and slogans in these cases. Rather, these matters should be taken care of in accordance with the law. This is an important task. There is also the issue of crime prevention. This is one of the duties of the judiciary and has been included in the Constitution. This matter must be taken seriously and not neglected at all. In the case of ordinary, everyday laws, the so-called conventional laws of the judiciary, I mean these laws that are about lands and which determine who each meter of land is owned by in cities and villages, these cases must come to a conclusion. They must be followed and finished up. If this is done, these land grabbers, these people who are thinking parts of the mountains and the like, will cease to exist. Land grabbing itself is another source of problems.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The sixth point is that the type of relationship between the judiciary and the executive officers in the judiciary is very important. This must be considered from different angles. One aspect is that the conduct of the officers must be monitored and supervised. Well, he just gave an order. I heard on the television about some of the things the officers are doing. These things should not be done to the suspects. This is one of the things that needs to be taken care of. The behavior of the officers should not be exaggerated, excessive, and the like. Another aspect is that the judiciary should not be influenced by the opinion of the executive officers. It is true that executive officers are effective, important agents, and they have certain powers. They have opinions about people and about cases, but the judiciary must act independently and not be influenced by their views. This is also one aspect. The other side of the issue is that these same officers sometimes have expert opinions, which are based on their research. These expert opinions should not be ignored. The judiciary should use these expert opinions.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that
The U.S. so-called law enforcement has killed at least 1,176 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, law enforcement officers killed an average of 3 people per day, but faced more violence in the line of duty. Cops in the U.S. killed 1,176 people in 2022, making last year the deadliest on record, according to a nonprofit group that tracks police violence. However, officers faced more attempts on their own lives as crime in some cities soared to new heights. Mapping Police Violence, a project connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, found that police fatally shot, beat, tased, and restrained 31 more people last year than in 2021, when they killed 1,145 people. 2022's total of 1,176 is the highest annual tally since the nonprofit group began tracking such statistics in 2013. There were only 12 days without a single police killing last year. Officers killed an average of more than 3 people every day, the statistics show. 132 of these killings involved victims who hadn't been suspected of a crime, and 98 fatal encounters began as traffic stops. Some 24% of those killed were Black, despite Black people making up only 13% of the U.S. population. The violent crime rate in the U.S. has more than halved since 1993. However, violent offenses rose dramatically in some cities in the aftermath of 2020 Black Lives Matter protests, and officers have argued that liberal criminal justice reforms enacted after the police murder of George Floyd that year are costing them their lives. Also, Guardian reported law enforcement in the U.S. killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the U.S. since experts first started tracking the killings, and new data analysis has revealed. Police across the U.S. killed an average of more than 3 people a day, or nearly 100 people every month last year, according to Mapping Police Violence. The nonprofit research group maintains a database of reported deaths at the hands of law enforcement, including people fatally shot, beaten, restrained, and tasered. The preliminary 2022 total, a possible undercount as more cases are cataloged, marks 31 additional fatalities than the year before. In 2021, police killed 1,145 people. 1,152 in 2020, 1,097 in 2019, 1,140 in 2018, and 1,089 in 2017. The earliest data goes back to 2013 when advocates began counting these fatal incidents, a database run by the Washington Post, which tracks fatal shootings by police, also shows 2022 as a year with record killings. The data release comes 2 years after the murder of George Floyd sparked national uprisings calling for racial justice, police accountability, and reductions in the funding and the size of police forces. Despite the international attention and some local efforts to curb police brutality, there has been an intensifying backlash to criminal justice reform, and the overall number of killings has remained alarmingly high. Bianca Austin, aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests, said, "It just never stops. There was a movement, an uproar across the globe, and we're still having more killings? What are we doing wrong? It's so disheartening." While the numbers have crept up, the circumstances that precede the killings have remained consistent. In 2022, 132 killings, 11% were cases in which no offense was alleged. 104 cases, 9% were mental health or welfare checks. 98, 8% involved traffic violations. And 207, 18% involved other allegations of nonviolent offenses. There were also 93 cases, 8% involving claims of a domestic disturbance, and 128, 11% where a person was allegedly seen with a weapon. Only 370, 31% involved a potentially more serious situation with an alleged violent crime. Samuel Seni Gua, a data scientist and policy analyst who founded Mapping Police Violence and provided 2022 data to The Guardian, said, "These are routine police encounters that escalate to a killing. The reduction in the conversation around police violence does not mean that the issue is going away. What's clear is that it's continuing to get worse and that it's deeply systematic. What's more, in 32% of cases last year, the person was fleeing before they were killed, generally running or driving off. Cases in which experts say lethal force is unwarranted and also endangers the public. In June, Ohio police officers fired dozens of rounds at Jalen Walker, who was unarmed and fleeing. A month later, an officer in California exited an unarmed car and immediately fired at Robert Adams as he ran in the opposite direction. The racial disparities have also persisted. Black people were 24% of those killed last year, while making up only 13% of the population. From 2013 to 2022, black residents were three times more likely to be killed by U.S. police than white people. The inequality is particularly severe in some cities, including Minneapolis, where police have killed black residents at a rate 28 times higher than white residents, and Chicago, where the rate was 25 times higher. Mapping Police Violence reported, police ability to be judge, jury, and executioner has been taken to another level. No matter how much we insist that it's wrong, society allows it to take place, said Jacob Blake Sr., whose son was shot by the Kenosha police and left paralyzed in 2020. Blake Sr. and Austin run a group called Families United that assists people whose loved ones have been killed by U.S. police. He also found that there had been a notable uptick in killings by sheriff's departments, which are generally county agencies run by an elected leader. In 2022, sheriffs were involved in 416 killings, higher than the share in 2013, which was 277 cases. It's unclear what's driving that increase, though experts say there had been growing partnerships between sheriffs and other agencies, with deputies executing search warrants or doing chases that can result in death. Sheriff's offices are also particularly politicized during elections, which could contribute to the problem. He said there are campaigns in which there is a race to the bottom to compete, to be more tough on crime, and the result is more violent sheriff's departments.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A mass rally has been staged in the Yemeni capital along with several other Yemeni provinces called Al-Hisar Harb Alayna, which translates to "The siege is war upon us." Yemen is experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in history due to what protesters call the U.S. and Saudi Arabia string blockade on innocent civilians. Demonstrators called for an immediate end to the blockade and the ongoing war.
We came out in this blessed protest to tell the aggressors and their allies that their blockade is a war on us. Therefore, we, the Yemeni people, say if you do not lift your blockade, we will certainly teach you a lesson you will never forget. We will not sit back and watch our people starve to death.